Chapter 5. Disappearance of an Old Lady. Aunt Ada's things arrived in due course. The desk was installed and admired. The little work table dispossessed the whatnot, which was relegated to a dark corner of the hall, and the picture of the pale pink house by the canal bridge Tuppence hung over the mantelpiece in her bedroom, where she could see it every morning when drinking her early morning tea. Since her conscience still troubled her a little, Tuppence wrote a letter explaining how the picture had come into her possession, but that if Mrs. Lancaster would like it returned, she had only got to let them know. This she dispatched to Mrs. Lancaster, care of Mrs. Johnson, at the Cleveland Hotel, George Street, London W1. To this there was no reply, but a week later the letter was returned with "not known at this address" scrawled on it. "How tiresome," said Tuppence.
"Or perhaps they only stayed for a night or two," suggested Tommy.
"You'd think they'd have left a forwarding address."
"Did you put 'please forward' on it?"
"Yes, I did. I know. I'll ring them up and ask. They must have put an address in the hotel register."
"I'd let it go if I were you," said Tommy. "Why make all this fuss? I expect the old pussy's forgotten all about the picture."
"Well, I might as well try." Tuppence sat down at the telephone and was presently connected to the Cleveland Hotel. She rejoined Tommy in his study a few minutes later. "It's rather curious, Tommy. They haven't even been there. No Mrs. Johnson, no Mrs. Lancaster, no rooms booked for them, or any trace of their having stayed there before."
"I expect Miss Packard got the name of the hotel wrong. Wrote it down in a hurry and then perhaps lost it or remembered it wrong. Things like that often happen, you know."
"Well, I shouldn't have thought it would at Sunny Ridge. Miss Packard is so efficient always."
"Perhaps they didn't book beforehand at the hotel and it was full, so they had to go somewhere else. You know what accommodation is like in London. Must you go on fussing?"
Tuppence retired. Presently she came back. "I know what I'm going to do. I'll ring up Miss Packard and I'll get the address of the lawyers."
"What lawyers?
Don't you remember she said something about a firm of solicitors who made all the arrangements because the Johnsons were abroad?"
Tommy, who was busy over a speech he was drafting for a conference he was shortly to attend, and murmuring under his breath, "The proper policy of such a contingency should arise," said,
"How do you spell contingency, Tuppence? Did you hear what I was saying?"
"Oh, yes, very good idea, splendid, excellent, you do that."
Tuppence went out, stuck her head in again, and said, "CONSISTENCY. "Can't be. You've got the wrong word."
"Well, what are you writing about?"
"The paper I'm reading at the next IUAS. And I do wish you would let me do it in peace."
"Sorry."
Tuppence removed herself. Tommy continued to write sentences and then scratch them out. His face was just brightening as the pace of his writing increased, when once more the door opened.
"Here it is," said Tuppence. "Partingdale Harris, Lockridge and Partingdale. 32 Lincoln Terrace, WC2. Telephone, Hoban, 051386. The operative member of the firm is Mr. Eccles."
She placed a sheet of paper by Tommy's elbow.
"Now, you take on."
"No," said Tommy firmly.
"Yes, she's your Aunt Ada." "Where does Aunt Ada come in?"
"Mrs. Lancaster is no aunt of mine."
"But it's lawyers," Tuppence insisted. "It's a man's job always to deal with lawyers. They just think women are silly and don't pay attention."
"A very sensible point of view," said Tommy.
"Oh, Tommy, do help. You go and telephone and I'll find the dictionary and look how to spell contingency."
Tommy gave her a look, but departed. He returned at last and spoke firmly. "This matter is now closed, Tuppence."
"You got Mr. Eccles?"
"Well, strictly speaking, I got a Mr. Wills, who is doubtless the dog's body in the firm of Partingford, Lockjaw and Harrison, but he was fully informed and glib. All letters and communications go via Southern Counties Bank, Hammersmith Branch, who will forward all communications. And there, Tuppence, let me tell you, the trail stops. Banks will forward things, but they won't yield any addresses to you or anyone else who asks. They have their code of rules and they'll stick to them. Their lips are sealed, like our more pompous prime ministers."
"All right. I'll send a letter, care of the bank."
"Do that.
And for goodness sake, leave me alone, or I shall never get my speech done."
"Thank you, darling," said Tuppence. "I don't know what I'd do without you."
She kissed the top of his head.
"It's the best butter," said Tommy. It was not until the following Thursday evening that Tommy asked suddenly, "By the way, did you ever get any answer to the letter you sent care of the bank to Mrs. Johnson?"
"It's nice of you to ask," said Tuppence sarcastically. "No, I didn't."
She added meditatively, "I don't think I shall either."
"Why not?"
"You're not really interested," said Tuppence coldly.
"Look here, Tuppence, I know I've been rather preoccupied. It's all this IUAS. It's only once a year, thank goodness.
It starts on Monday, doesn't it, for 5 days?"
4 days.
"And you all go down to a hush-hush, top-secret house in the country somewhere, and make speeches and read papers and vet young men for super-secret assignments in Europe and beyond. I've forgotten what IUAS stands for, all these initials they have nowadays.
International Union of Associated Security.
What a mouthful. Quite ridiculous. And I expect the whole place is bugged, and everybody knows everybody else's most secret conversations."
"Highly likely," said Tommy with a grin.
"And I suppose you enjoy it?"
"Well, I do, in a way. One sees a lot of old friends.
All quite gaga by now, I expect. Does any of it do any good?"
"Heavens, what a question. Can one ever let oneself believe that you can answer that by a plain yes or no?"
"And are any of the people any good?"
"I'd answer yes to that. Some of them are very good indeed."
"Will old Josh be there?"
"Yes, he'll be there."
"What's he like nowadays?"
"Extremely deaf, half blind, crippled with rheumatism, and you'd be surprised at the things that don't get past him."
"I see," said Tuppence.
She meditated.
"I wish I were in it too."
Tommy looked apologetic.
"Well, I expect you'll find something to do while I'm away."
"Yes, I might at that," said Tuppence meditatively.
Her husband looked at her with the vague apprehension that Tuppence could always arouse in him.
"Tuppence, what are you up to?"
"Oh, nothing. Yet. So far, I'm only thinking."
"What about?"
"Sunny Ridge. And a nice old lady sipping milk and talking in a scatty kind of way about dead children and fireplaces. Intrigued me. I thought then that I'd try and find out more from her next time we came to see Aunt Ada, but there wasn't a next time because Aunt Ada died. And when we were next in Sunny Ridge, Mrs. Lancaster had disappeared."
"You mean her people had taken her away? That's not a disappearance. It's quite natural.
It's a disappearance. No traceable address. No answer to letters. It's a planned disappearance. I'm more and more sure of it."
"But..." Tuppence broke in upon his butt.
"Listen, Tommy. Supposing that sometime or other a crime happened. It seemed all safe and covered up. But then, suppose that someone in the family had seen something or known something. Someone elderly and garrulous, someone who chattered to people, someone whom you suddenly realized might be a danger to you. What would you do about it?"
"Arsenic in the soup," suggested Tommy cheerfully. "Cosh them on the head. Push them down the staircase."
"That's rather extreme. Sudden deaths attract attention. You'd look about for some simpler way, and you'd find one. A nice, respectable home for elderly ladies. You'd pay a visit to it, calling yourself Mrs. Johnson or Mrs. Robinson. You would get some unsuspecting third party to make arrangements. You'd fix the financial arrangements through a firm of reliable solicitors. You've already hinted, perhaps, that your elderly relative has fancies and mild delusions sometimes. So do a good many of the other old ladies. Nobody will think it odd if she cackles on about poisoned milk or dead children behind a fireplace or a sinister kidnapping. Nobody will really listen. They'll just think, oh, it's old Mrs. So-and-so having her fancies again. Nobody will take any notice at all."
"Except Mrs. Thomas Beresford," said Tommy.
"All right, yes," said Tuppence. "I've taken notice. But why did you?"
"I don't quite know," said Tuppence slowly. "It's like the fairy stories. By the pricking of my thumbs, something evil this way comes." I felt suddenly scared. I'd always thought of Sunny Ridge as such a normal, happy place, and suddenly I began to wonder. That's the only way I can put it. I wanted to find out more. And now poor old Mrs. Lancaster has disappeared. Somebody spirited her away.
But why should they?
I can only think because she was getting worse. worse from their point of view, remembering more, perhaps. Talking to people more, or perhaps she recognized someone, or someone recognized her, or told her something that gave her new ideas about something that had once happened. Anyway, for some reason or other, she became dangerous to someone. Look here, Tuppence, this whole thing is all somethings and someones. It's just an idea you've thought up. You don't want to go mixing yourself up in things that are no business of yours. But there's nothing to be mixed up in, according to you, said Tuppence. So you needn't worry at all. You leave Sunny Ridge alone. Oh, I don't mean to go back to Sunny Ridge. I think they've told me all they know there. I think that old lady was quite safe while she was there. I want to find out where she is now. I want to get to her, wherever she is, in time, before something happens to her. What on earth do you think might happen to her? I don't like to think, but I'm on the trail. I'm going to be Prudence Beresford, private investigator. Do you remember when we were Blunt's brilliant detectives? I was, said Tommy. You were Miss Robinson, my private secretary. Not all the time. Anyway, that's what I'm going to do while you're playing at international espionage at Hush Hush Manor. It's the Save Mrs. Lancaster that I'm going to be busy with. You'll probably find her perfectly all right. I hope I shall. Nobody would be better pleased than I should. How do you propose to set about it? As I told you. I've got to think first. Perhaps an advertisement of some kind. No, that would be a mistake. Well, be careful, said Tommy rather inadequately. Tuppence did not deign to reply. On Monday morning, Albert, the domestic mainstay of the Beresford's life for many long years, ever since he had been roped into anti-criminal activities by them as a carroty-haired lift boy, deposited the tray of early morning tea on the table between the two beds, pulled back the curtains, announced that it was a fine day, and removed his now portly form from the room. Tuppence yawned, sat up, rubbed her eyes, poured out a cup of tea, dropped a slice of lemon in it, and remarked that it seemed a nice day, but you never knew. Tommy turned over and groaned. Wake up, said Tuppence. Remember, you're going places today.
Oh, Lord, said Tommy. So I am.
He, too, sat up and helped himself to tea. He looked with appreciation at the picture over the mantelpiece. I must say, Tuppence, your picture looks very nice.
It's the way the sun comes in from the window sideways and lights it up.
Peaceful, said Tommy.
If only I could remember where it was I'd seen it before.
I can't see that it matters. You'll remember sometime or other.
Well, that's no good. I want to remember now.
But why?
Well, don't you see? It's the only clue I've got. It was Mrs. Lancaster's picture.
But the two things don't tie up together anyway, said Tommy. I mean, it's true that the picture once belonged to Mrs. Lancaster, but it may have been just a picture she bought at an exhibition or that somebody in her family did. It may have been a picture that somebody gave her as a present. She took it to Sunny Ridge with her because she thought it looked nice. There's no reason it should have anything to do with her personally. If it had, she wouldn't have given it to Aunt Ada.
It's the only clue I've got, said Tuppence.
It's a nice, peaceful house, said Tommy.
All the same, I think it's an empty house.
Well, what do you mean, empty?
Well, I don't think, said Tuppence, there's anybody living in it. I don't think anybody's ever going to come out of that house. Nobody's going to walk across that bridge. Nobody's going to untie that boat and row away in it.
For goodness sake, Tuppence.
Tommy stared at her. What's the matter with you? I thought so the first time I saw it, said Tuppence. I thought, what a nice house that would be to live in. And then I thought, but nobody does live there. I'm sure they don't. That shows you that I've seen it before. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. It's coming. It's coming.
Tommy stared at her.
Out of a window, said Tuppence breathlessly. Out of a car window? No, that would be the wrong angle. Running alongside the canal, and a little humpback bridge, and the pink walls of the house, the two poplar trees, more than two. There were lots more poplar trees. Dear, oh dear, if I could...
Oh, come off it, Tuppence.
It will come back to me.
Good Lord. Tommy looked at his watch. I've got to hurry. You and your déjà vu picture. He jumped out of bed and hastened to the bathroom. Tuppence lay back on her pillows and closed her eyes, trying to force a recollection that had just remained elusively out of reach. Tommy was pouring out a certain cup of coffee in the dining room when Tuppence appeared, flushed with triumph.
I've got it. I know where I saw that house. It was out of the window of a railway train.
Oh, where? When?
I don't know. I'll have to think. I remember saying to myself, someday I'll go and look at that house, and I tried to see what the name of the next station was.
But you know what railways are nowadays. They've pulled down half the stations, and the next one we went through was all torn down and grass growing over the platforms and no name board or anything. And where the hell's my briefcase? Albert! A frenzied search took place.
Tommy came back to say a breathless goodbye. Tuppence was sitting looking meditatively at a fried egg.
Goodbye, said Tommy.
And for God's sake, Tuppence, don't go poking into something that's none of your business.
I think, said Tuppence meditatively, that what I shall really do is to take a few railway journeys.
Tommy looked slightly relieved.
Yes, he said encouragingly. You try that. Buy yourself a season ticket. There's some scheme where you can travel 1,000 miles all over the British Isles for a very reasonable fixed sum. That ought to suit you down to the ground, Tuppence. You travel by all the trains you can think of, in all the likely parts. That ought to keep you happy until I come home again.
Give my love to Josh.
I will,
he added, looking at his wife in a worried manner.
I wish you were coming with me. Don't go and do anything stupid, will you?
Of course not, said Tuppence.
Chapter 6 Tuppence on the Trail.
Oh dear, sighed Tuppence. Oh dear. She looked round her with gloomy eyes.
Never, she said to herself, had she felt more miserable. Naturally, she had known she would miss Tommy, but she'd had no idea how much she was going to miss him. During the long course of their married life, they'd hardly ever been separated for any length of time. Starting before their marriage, they had called themselves a pair of young adventurers. They had been through various difficulties and dangers together. They had married, they had had 2 children, and just as the world was seeming rather dull and middle-aged to them, the Second War had come about, and in what seemed an almost miraculous way, they had been tangled up yet again on the outskirts of British intelligence. A somewhat unorthodox pair, they had been recruited by a quiet, nondescript man who called himself Mr. Carter, but to whose word everybody seemed to bow. They had had adventures, and once again they had had them together. This, by the way, had not been planned by Mr. Carter. Tommy alone had been recruited, but Tuppence, displaying all her natural ingenuity, had managed to eavesdrop in such a fashion that when Tommy had arrived at a guest house on the south coast in the role of a certain Mr. Meadows, the first person he had seen there had been a middle-aged lady plying knitting needles, who had looked up at him with innocent eyes and whom he had been forced to greet as Mrs. Blenkinsop. Thereafter, they had worked as a pair. However, thought Tuppence to herself, I can't do it this time. No amount of eavesdropping, of ingenuity, or anything else would take her to the recesses of Hush Hush Manor, or to participation in the intricacies of IUAS. Just an old boys' club, she thought resentfully. Without Tommy, the flat was empty. The world was lonely. And what on earth, thought Tuppence, am I to do with myself? The question was really purely rhetorical, but Tuppence had already started on the first steps of what she planned to do with herself. There was no question this time of intelligence work, of counter-espionage or anything of that kind, nothing of an official nature. Prudence Beresford, private investigator. That's what I am, said Tuppence to herself. After a scrappy lunch had been hastily cleared away, the dining room table was strewn with railway timetables, guidebooks, maps, and a few old diaries, which Tuppence had managed to disinter. Sometime in the last 3 years, not longer, she was sure, she had taken a railway journey, and looking out of the carriage window, she had noticed a house. But what railway journey? Like most people at the present time, the Beresfords travelled mainly by car. The railway journeys they took were few and far between. Scotland, of course, when they went to stay with their married daughter Deborah, but that was a night journey. Penzance, summer holidays, but Tuppence knew that line by heart. No, this had been a much more casual journey. With diligence and perseverance, Tuppence had made a meticulous list of all the possible journeys she had taken which might correspond to what she was looking for. One or two race meetings, a visit to Northumberland, two possible places in Wales, a christening, two weddings, a sale they had attended, some puppies she had once delivered for a friend who bred them and who had gone down with influenza. The meeting place had been an arid-looking country junction, whose name she couldn't remember. Tuppence sighed. It seemed as though Tommy's solution was the one she might have to adopt. Buy a kind of circular ticket and actually travel over the most likely stretches of railway line. In a small notebook, she had dotted down any snatches of extra memories, vague flashes, in case they might help. A hat, for instance. Yes, a hat that she had thrown up on the rack. She had been wearing a hat, so a wedding, or the christening, certainly not puppies. And another flash, kicking off her shoes because her feet hurt. Yes, that was definite. She had been actually looking at the house, and she had kicked off her shoes because her feet hurt. So then it had definitely been a social function she had either been going to or returning from. Returning from, of course, because of the painfulness of her feet from long standing about in her best shoes. And what kind of a hat? Because that would help. A flowery hat? A summer wedding? Or a velvet winter one? Tuppence was busy jotting down details from the railway timetables of different lines when Albert came in to ask what she wanted for supper and what she wanted ordered in from the butcher and the grocer. "I think I'm going to be away for the next few days," said Tuppence, "so you needn't order in anything. I'm going to take some railway journeys. Will you be wanting some sandwiches?" "Well, I might. Get some ham or something. Egg and cheese, do you? Or there's a tin of pâté in the larder. It's been there a long while. Time it was eaten." It was a somewhat sinister recommendation, but Tuppence said, "Oh, all right, that'll do. Do you want letters forwarded?" "I don't even know where I'm going yet," said Tuppence. "I see," said Albert. The comfortable thing about Albert was that he always accepted everything. Nothing ever had to be explained to him. He went away, and Tuppence settled down to her planning. What she wanted was a social engagement involving a hat and party shoes. Unfortunately, the ones she had listed involved different railway lines. One wedding on the Southern Railway, the other in East Anglia, the christening north of Bedford. If she could remember a little more about the scenery. She had been sitting on the right-hand side of the train. What had she been looking at before the canal? Woods? Trees? Farmland? A distant village? Straining her brain, she looked up with a frown. Albert had come back. How far she was at that moment from knowing that Albert, standing there waiting for attention, was neither more nor less than an answer to a prayer. "What is it now, Albert? If it's that you're going to be away all day tomorrow, and the day after as well, probably, would it be all right for me to have the day off?" "Well, yes, of course. It's Elizabeth, come out in spots she has. Millie thinks it's measles." "Oh, dear." Millie was Albert's wife, and Elizabeth was the youngest of his children. "So Millie wants you at home, of course." Albert lived in a small, neat house, a street or two away. "Oh, it's not that so much. She likes me out the way when she's got her hands full. She doesn't want me messing things up, but it's the other kids. I could take them somewhere out of her way." "Of course, you're all in quarantine, I suppose." "Oh, well, best for them all to get it over. Charlie's had it, so has Jean. Anyway, that'll be all right." Tuppence assured him that it would be all right. Something was stirring in the depths of her subconscious. A happy anticipation. A recognition. Measles. Yes, measles. Something to do with measles.
But why should the house by the canal have anything to do with measles?
Of course, Anthea.
Anthea was Tuppence's goddaughter, and Anthea's daughter Jane was at school her first term, and it was prize-giving, and Anthea had rung up. Her two younger children had come out in a measles rash, and she had nobody in the house to help, and Jane would be terribly disappointed if nobody came. Could Tuppence possibly... And Tuppence had said, of course. She wasn't doing anything in particular. She'd go down to the school and take Jane out and give her lunch and then go back to the sports and all the rest of it. There was a special school train. Everything came back into her mind with astonishing clarity. Even the dress she'd worn, a summer print of cornflowers. She had seen the house on the return journey. Going down there, she'd been absorbed in a magazine she had brought. But coming back, she had had nothing to read, and she had looked out of the window until, exhausted by the activities of the day and the pressure of her shoes, she had dropped off to sleep. When she had woken up, the train had been running beside a canal. It was partially wooded country, an occasional bridge, sometimes a twisting lane or minor road, a distant farm, no villages. The train began to slow down, for no reason it would seem except that a signal must be against it. It drew jerkily to a halt by a bridge, a little humpback bridge, which spanned the canal, a disused canal, presumably. On the other side of the canal, close to the water, was the house, a house that Tuppence thought at once was one of the most attractive houses she had ever seen, a quiet, peaceful house, irradiated by the golden light of the late afternoon sun. There was no human being to be seen, no dogs or livestock, yet the green shutters were not fastened. The house must be lived in. But now, at this moment, it was empty. I must find out about that house, Tuppence had thought. Some day, I must come back here and look at it. It's the kind of house I'd like to live in. With a jerk, the train lurched slowly forwards. I'll look out for the name of the next station, so that I'll know where it is. But there had been no appropriate station. It was the time when things were beginning to happen to railways. Small stations were closed, even pulled down. Grass sprouted on the decayed platforms. For 20 minutes, half an hour, the train ran on, but nothing identifiable was to be seen. Over fields in the far distance, Tuppence once saw the spire of a church. Then had come some factory complex. Tall chimneys, a line of prefab houses. Then open country again. Tuppence had thought to herself, that house was rather like a dream. Perhaps it was a dream. I don't suppose I'll ever go and look for it. Too difficult. Besides, rather a pity, perhaps. Some day maybe I'll come across it by accident. And so she had forgotten all about it, until a picture hanging on a wall had reawakened a veiled memory. And now, thanks to one word uttered unwittingly by Albert, the quest was ended. Or, to speak correctly, a quest was beginning. Tuppence sorted out 3 maps, a guidebook, and various other accessories. Roughly, now, she knew the area she would have to search. Jane's school she marked with a large cross, a branch railway line which ran into the main line to London. The time-lapse, whilst she had slept. The final area, as planned, covered a considerable mileage, north of Medchester, southeast of Market Basing, which was a small town, but was quite an important railway junction, west, probably, of Shaleborough. She'd take the car and start early tomorrow morning. She got up, went into the bedroom, and studied the picture over the mantelpiece. Yes, there was no mistake. That was the house she had seen from the train 3 years ago. The house she had promised to look for someday. Someday had come. Someday was tomorrow. Book 2. The House on the Canal. Chapter 7. The Friendly Witch. Before leaving the next morning, Tuppence took a last careful look at the picture hanging in her room. Not so much to fix its details firmly in her mind, but to memorize its position in the landscape. This time she would be seeing it not from the window of a train, but from the road. The angle of approach would be quite different. There might be many humpback bridges, many similar disused canals,
Perhaps other houses looking like this one. But that Tuppence refused to believe. The picture was signed, but the signature of the artist was illegible. All that could be said was that it began with a B. Turning away from the picture, Tuppence checked her paraphernalia. An ABC and its attached railway map, a selection of ordnance maps, tentative names of places, Medchester, Westley, Market Basing, Middlesham, Inchwell. Between them, they enclosed the triangle that she had decided to examine. With her, she took a small overnight bag, since she would have a 3 hours' drive before she even arrived at the area of operations, and after that, it meant, she judged, a good deal of slow driving along country roads and lanes, looking for likely canals. After stopping in Medchester for coffee and a snack, she pushed on by a second-class road adjacent to a railway line and leading through wooded country with plenty of streams. As in most of the rural districts of England, signposts were plentiful, bearing names that Tuppence had never heard of, and seldom seeming to lead to the place in question. There seemed to be a certain cunning about this part of the road system in England. The road would twist off from the canal, and when you pressed on hopefully to where you thought the canal might have taken itself, you drew a blank. If you had gone on in the direction of Great Mitchelden, the next signpost you came to offered you a choice of two roads, one to Pennington Sparrow, the other to Farlingford. You chose Farlingford and managed actually to get to such a place, but almost immediately the next signpost sent you back firmly to Medchester, so that you practically retraced your steps. Actually, Tuppence never did find Great Mitchelden, and for a long time she was quite unable to find the lost canal. If she had had any idea of which village she was looking for, things might have gone more easily. Tracking canals on maps was merely puzzling. Now and again she came to the railway, which cheered her up, and she would then push on hopefully for Bees Hill, South Winterton, and Farrell St. Edmund. Farrell St. Edmund had once had a station, but it had been abolished some time ago. If only, thought Tuppence, there was some well-behaved road that ran alongside a canal or alongside a railway line, it would make it so much easier. The day wore on, and Tuppence became more and more baffled. Occasionally she came upon a farm adjacent to a canal, but the road, having led to the farm, insisted on having nothing more to do with the canal and went over the hill and arrived at something called Westbenfold, which had a church with a square tower, which was no use at all. From there, when disconsolately pursuing a rutted road which seemed the only way out of Westbenfold, and which to Tuppence's sense of direction, which was now becoming increasingly unreliable, seemed to lead in the opposite direction to anywhere she could possibly want to go, she came abruptly to a place where two lanes forked left and right. There was the remains of a signpost between them, the arms of which had both broken off. "Which way?" said Tuppence. "Who knows? I don't." She took the left-hand one. It meandered on, winding to left and to right. Finally it shot round a bend, widened out and climbed a hill, coming out of woods into open, down-like country. Having surmounted the crest, it took a steep downward course. Not very far away, a plaintive cry sounded. "Sounds like a train," said Tuppence, with sudden hope. It was a train. Then, below her was the railway line, and on it a goods train uttering cries of distress as it puffed along. And beyond it was the canal, and on the other side of the canal was a house that Tuppence recognized. And leading across the canal was a small, humped-backed, pink-bricked bridge. The road dipped under the railway line, came up, and made for the bridge. Tuppence drove very gently over the narrow bridge. Beyond it, the road went on with the house on the right-hand side of it. Tuppence drove on, looking for the way in. There didn't seem to be one. A fairly high wall shielded it from the road. The house was on her right now. She stopped the car and walked back onto the bridge and looked at what she could see of the house from there. Most of the tall windows were shuttered with green shutters. The house had a very quiet and empty look. It looked peaceful and kindly in the setting sun. There was nothing to suggest that anyone lived in it. She went back to the car and drove a little further. The wall, a moderately high one, ran along to her right. The left-hand side of the road was merely a hedge giving on green fields. Presently she came to a wrought-iron gate in the wall. She parked the car by the side of the road, got out, and went over to look through the ironwork of the gate. By standing on tiptoe, she could look over it. What she looked into was a garden. The place was certainly not a farm now, though it must have been once. Presumably it gave on fields beyond it. The garden was tended and cultivated. It was not particularly tidy, but it looked as though someone was trying rather unsuccessfully to keep it tidy. From the iron gate, a circular path curved through the garden and round to the house. This must be presumably the front door, though it didn't look like a front door. It was inconspicuous, though sturdy. A back door. The house looked quite different from this side. To begin with, it was not empty. People lived there. Windows were open. Curtains fluttered at them. A garbage pail stood by the door. At the far end of the garden, Tuppence could see a large man digging. A big, elderly man who dug slowly and with persistence. Certainly, looked at from here, the house held no enchantment. No artist would have wanted particularly to paint it. It was just a house, and somebody lived in it. Tuppence wondered. She hesitated. Should she go on and forget the house altogether? No, she could hardly do that, not after all the trouble she had taken. What time is it? She looked at her watch, but her watch had stopped. The sound of a door opening came from inside. She peered through the gate again. The door of the house had opened, and a woman came out. She put down a milk bottle, and then, straightening up, glanced towards the gate. She saw Tuppence and hesitated for a moment, and then, seeming to make up her mind, she came down the path towards the gate. Why? Said Tuppence to herself. Why, it's a friendly witch. It was a woman of about 50. She had long, straggly hair, which, when caught by the wind, flew out behind her. It reminded Tuppence vaguely of a picture, by Nevinson, of a young witch on a broomstick. That is perhaps why the term witch had come into her mind. But there was nothing young or beautiful about this woman. She was middle-aged, with a lined face, dressed in a rather slipshod way. She had a kind of steeple hat perched on her head, and her nose and her chin came up towards each other. As a description, she could have been sinister, but she did not look sinister. She seemed to have a beaming and boundless goodwill. Yes, thought Tuppence, you're exactly like a witch, but you're a friendly witch. I expect you're what they used to call a white witch. The woman came down in a hesitating manner to the gate and spoke. Her voice was pleasant, with a faint country burr in it of some kind. "Were you looking for anything?" she said. "Oh, I'm sorry," said Tuppence. "You must think it very rude of me looking into your garden in this way, but I wondered about this house." "Well, would you like to come in and look round the garden?" said the friendly witch. Well, thank you, but I don't want to bother you." "Oh, it's no bother. I've nothing to do. Lovely afternoon, isn't it?" "Yes, it is," said Tuppence. "I thought perhaps you'd lost your way," said the friendly witch. "People do sometimes." "I just thought," said Tuppence, "that this was a very attractive-looking house when I came down the hill on the other side of the bridge." "Well, that's the prettiest side," said the woman. "Artists come and sketch it sometimes." "Or they used to, once." "Yes," said Tuppence. "I expect they would. I believe I saw a picture at some exhibition," she added hurriedly. "Some house very like this. Perhaps it was this." "Oh, it may have been. Funny, you know, artists come and do a picture, and then other artists seem to come too. It's just the same when they have the local picture show every year. Artists all seem to choose the same spot. I don't know why. You know, it's either a bit of meadow and a brook, or a particular oak tree, or a clump of willows, or it's the same view of the Norman church. 5 or 6 different pictures of the same thing. Most of them pretty bad, I should think. But then, I don't know anything about art. Come in, do." "Well, you're very kind," said Tuppence. "You've got a very nice garden," she added. "Oh, it's not too bad. We've got a few flowers and vegetables and things. But my husband can't do much work nowadays, and I've got no time with one thing and another."
I saw this house once from the train, said Tuppence. The train slowed up and I saw this house and I wondered whether I'd ever see it again. Quite some time ago. And now suddenly you've come down the hill in your car and there it is, said the woman. Funny. Things happen like that, don't they?
Thank goodness, Tuppence thought. This woman is extraordinarily easy to talk to. One hardly has to imagine anything to explain oneself. One can almost say just what comes into one's head.
Like to come inside the house? Said the friendly witch. I can see you're interested. It's quite an old house, you know. I mean, late Georgian or something like that, they say. Only it's been added on to, of course. We've only got half the house, you know.
Oh, I see, said Tuppence.
It's divided in two, is that it?
Well, this is really the back of it, said the woman. The front's the other side, the side you saw from the bridge.
It was a funny way to partition it, I should have thought. I'd have thought it would have been easier to do it the other way. You know, right and left, so to speak, not back and front. This is all really the back.
Have you lived here long? Asked Tuppence.
3 years. After my husband retired, we wanted a little place somewhere in the country where we'd be quiet. Somewhere cheap. This was going cheap, because of course it's very lonely. You're not near a village or anything.
I saw a church steeple in the distance.
Ah, that's Sutton Chancellor, 2.5 miles from here. We're in the parish, of course, but there aren't any houses until you get to the village. It's a very small village, too.
You'll have a cup of tea, said the friendly witch. I just put the kettle on not 2 minutes ago when I looked out and saw you.
She raised both hands to her mouth and shouted,
Amos! Amos!
The big man in the distance turned his head.
Tea in 10 minutes,
she called. He acknowledged the signal by raising his hand. She turned, opened the door and motioned Tuppence to go in.
Perry, my name is, she said in a friendly voice. Alice Perry.
Oh, mine's Beresford, said Tuppence. Mrs. Beresford.
Oh, come in, Mrs. Beresford, and have a look round.
Tuppence paused for a second. She thought,
just for a moment I feel like Hansel and Gretel. The witch asks you into her house. Perhaps it's a gingerbread house. It ought to be.
Then she looked at Alice Perry again and thought that it wasn't the gingerbread house of Hansel and Gretel's witch. This was just a perfectly ordinary woman. No, not quite ordinary. She had a rather strange, wild friendliness about her. She might be able to do spells, thought Tuppence, but I'm sure they'd be good spells. She stooped her head a little and stepped over the threshold into the witch's house. It was rather dark inside. The passages were small. Mrs. Perry led her through a kitchen and into a sitting room beyond it, which was evidently the family living room. There was nothing exciting about the house. It was, Tuppence thought, probably a late Victorian addition to the main part. Horizontally, it was narrow. It seemed to consist of a horizontal passage, rather dark, which served a string of rooms. She thought to herself that it certainly was rather an odd way of dividing a house.
Sit down and I'll bring the tea in, said Mrs. Perry.
Well, let me help you.
Oh, no, don't worry. I shan't be a minute. It's all ready on the tray.
A whistle rose from the kitchen. The kettle had evidently reached the end of its span of tranquillity. Mrs. Perry went out and returned in a minute or two with the tea tray, a plate of scones, a jar of jam, and 3 cups and saucers.
I expect you're disappointed now you've got inside, said Mrs. Perry.
It was a shrewd remark and very near to the truth.
Oh, no, said Tuppence. Well, I should be if I was you, because they don't match a bit, do they? I mean, the front and the back side of the house don't match.
But it is a comfortable house to live in. Not many rooms, not too much light, but it makes a great difference in price.
Who divided the house, and why?
Oh, a good many years ago, I believe. I suppose whoever had it thought it was too big or too inconvenient, only wanted a weekend place or something of that kind. So they kept the good rooms, the dining room and the drawing room, and made a kitchen out of a small study there was, and a couple of bedrooms and a bathroom upstairs, and then walled it up and let the part that was kitchens and old-fashioned sculleries and things and did it up a bit.
Who lives in the other part?
Someone who just comes down for weekends?
Nobody lives there now,
said Mrs. Perry. Have another scone, dear.
Oh, thank you, said Tuppence.
At least nobody's come down here in the last 2 years. I don't know even who it belongs to now.
But when you first came here, well, there was a young lady used to come down here. An actress, they said she was. At least, that's what we heard. But we never saw her, really. Just caught a glimpse sometimes. She used to come down late on a Saturday night after the show, I suppose. She used to go away on Sunday evenings.
Quite a mystery woman, said Tuppence encouragingly.
You know, that's just the way I used to think of her. I used to make up stories about her in my head. Sometimes I'd think she was like Greta Garbo, you know, the way she went about in dark glasses and pulled down hats. Oh, goodness now, I've got my peak hat on.
She removed the witch's headgear from her head and laughed.
It's for a play we're having at the parish rooms in Sutton Chancellor, she said. You know, a sort of fairy story play for the children, mostly. I'm playing the witch, she added.
Oh, said Tuppence, slightly taken aback. Then added quickly, what fun.
Yes, it is fun, isn't it, said Mrs. Perry.
Just right for the witch, aren't I?
Ha ha! She laughed and tapped her chin.
You know, I've got the face for it. Hope it won't put ideas into people's heads. They'll think I've got the evil eye.
I don't think they'd think that of you, said Tuppence. I'm sure you'd be a beneficent witch.
Well, I'm glad you think so, said Mrs. Perry.
As I was saying, this actress, I can't remember her name now, Miss Marchmont, I think it was, but it might have been something else. You wouldn't believe the things I used to make up about her. Really, I suppose I hardly ever saw or spoke to her. Sometimes I think she was just terribly shy and neurotic. Reporters had come down after her and things like that, but she never would see them. At other times I used to think, well, you'll see I'm foolish, I used to think quite sinister things about her, you know, that she was afraid of being recognised. Perhaps she wasn't an actress at all. Perhaps the police were looking for her. Perhaps she was a criminal of some kind. It's exciting sometimes making things up in your head, especially when you don't, well, see many people.
Did nobody ever come down here with her?
Well, I'm not so sure about that. Of course, these partition walls, you know, they put in when they turn the house into two, well, they're pretty thin, and sometimes you'd hear voices and things like that. I think she did bring down someone for weekends occasionally. She nodded her head. A man of some kind. That may have been why they wanted somewhere quiet like this.
A married man, said Tuppence, entering into the spirit of make-believe.
Yes, it would be a married man, wouldn't it? Said Mrs. Perry.
Perhaps it was her husband who came down with her. He'd taken this place in the country because he wanted to murder her, and perhaps he buried her in the garden.
My, said Mrs. Perry, you do have an imagination, don't you? I never thought of that one.
I suppose someone must have known all about her, said Tuppence. I mean, house agents, people like that.
Oh, I suppose so, said Mrs. Perry. But I rather like not knowing, if you understand what I mean.
Oh, yes, said Tuppence. I do understand.
It's got an atmosphere, you know, this house. I mean, there's a feeling in it, a feeling that anything might have happened.
Didn't she have any people come in to clean for her or anything like that?
Difficult to get anyone here. There's nobody near at hand.
The outside door opened. The big man who had been digging in the garden came in. He went to the scullery tap and turned it, obviously washing his hands. Then he came through into the sitting room.
This is my husband, said Mrs. Perry.
Amos. We've got a visitor.
Amos,
this is Mrs. Beresford.
How do you do? Said Tuppence.
Amos Perry was a tall, shambling-looking man. He was bigger and more powerful than Tuppence had realized. Although he had a shambling gait and walked slowly, he was a big man of muscular build. He said,
"Pleased to meet you, Mrs. Beresford."
His voice was pleasant, and he smiled, but Tuppence wondered for a brief moment whether he was really what she would have called all there. There was a kind of wondering simplicity about the look in his eyes, and she wondered, too, whether Mrs. Perry had wanted a quiet place to live in because of some mental disability on the part of her husband.
"Ever so fond of the garden, he is," said Mrs. Perry.
At his entrance, the conversation dimmed down. Mrs. Perry did most of the talking, but her personality seemed to have changed. She talked with rather more nervousness and with particular attention to her husband, encouraging him, Tuppence thought, rather in a way that a mother might prompt a shy boy to talk, to display the best of himself before a visitor, and to be a little nervous that he might be inadequate. When she'd finished her tea, Tuppence got up. She said, "Well, I must be going. Thank you, Mrs. Perry, very much for your hospitality."
"You'll see the garden before you go," Mr. Perry rose. "Come on, I'll show you."
She went with him outdoors, and he took her down to the corner beyond where he had been digging.
"Nice, them flowers, aren't they?" he said. "Got some old-fashioned roses here. See this one? Striped red and white."
"Commandant Beaurepaire," said Tuppence.
"Us calls it York and Lancaster here," said Perry. "Wars of the Roses. Smells sweet, don't it?"
"Smells lovely."
"Better than them new-fashioned hybrid teas."
In a way, the garden was rather pathetic. The weeds were imperfectly controlled, but the flowers themselves were carefully tied up in an amateurish fashion.
"Bright colours," said Mr. Perry. "I like bright colours."
"We often get folk to see our garden," he said. "Glad you came."
"Thank you very much," said Tuppence. "I think your garden and your house are very nice indeed."
"You ought to see t'other side of it."
"Is it to let or to be sold? Your wife says there's nobody living there now."
"We don't know. We've not seen anyone, and there's no board up, and nobody's ever come to see over it."
"It would be a nice house, I think, to live in."
"You're wanting a house?"
"Yes," said Tuppence, making up her mind quickly. "Yes, as a matter of fact, we are looking round for some small place in the country, for when my husband retires. That'll be next year, probably. But we like to look about in plenty of time."
"It's quiet here, if you like quiet."
"I suppose," said Tuppence, "I could ask the local house agents. Is that how you got your house?"
"Saw an advertisement first. We did in the paper. Then we went into the house agents, yes."
"Where was that, in Sutton Chancellor? That's your village, isn't it?"
"Sutton Chancellor? No, no. Agent's place is in Market Basing. Russell and Thompson, that's the name. You could go and ask them."
"Yes," said Tuppence. "So I could. How far is Market Basing from here?"
"It's 2 miles to Sutton Chancellor, and it's 7 miles to Market Basing from there. There's a proper road from Sutton Chancellor, but it's all lanes hereabouts."
"I see," said Tuppence. "Well, goodbye, Mr. Perry, and thank you very much for showing me your garden."
"Wait a bit."
He stooped, cut off an enormous peony, and taking Tuppence by the lapel of her coat, he inserted this through the buttonhole in it.
"There," he said. "There you are. Looks pretty, it does."
For a moment, Tuppence felt a sudden feeling of panic. This large, shambling, good-natured man suddenly frightened her. He was looking down at her, smiling rather wildly, almost leering.
"Pretty it looks on you," he said again. "Pretty."
Tuppence thought, "I'm glad I'm not a young girl. I don't think I'd like him putting a flower on me then." She said goodbye again and hurried away. The house door was open, and Tuppence went in to say goodbye to Mrs. Perry. Mrs. Perry was in the kitchen washing up the tea things, and Tuppence almost automatically pulled a tea cloth off the rack and started drying.
"Thank you so much," she said. "Both you and your husband, you've been so kind and hospitable to me." "What's that?"
From the wall of the kitchen, or rather behind the wall, where an old-fashioned range had once stood, there came a loud screaming and squawking and a scratching noise too.
"Oh, that'll be a jackdaw," said Mrs. Perry. "Drop down the chimney in the other house. They do this time of year. One came down our chimney last week. They make nests in the chimneys, you know."
"What, in the other house?"
"Yes, there it is again."
Again the squawking and crying of a distressed bird came to their ears. Mrs. Perry said, "There's no one to bother, you see, in the empty house. The chimneys ought to be swept and that." The squawking, scratching noises went on.
"Poor bird," said Tuppence.
"I know. It won't be able to get up again.
You mean it'll just die there?"
Oh, yes. One came down our chimney, as I say. Two of them, actually. One was a young bird. It was all right. We put it out and it flew away. The other one was dead. The frenzied scuffling and squeaking went on. Oh, said Tuppence, I wish we could get at it. Mr. Perry came in through the door. Anything the matter? He said, looking from one to the other. There's a bird, Amos. It must be in the drawing-room chimney next door. Hear it?
Eh? Oh, it's come down from the jackdaw's nest.
I wish we could get in there, said Mrs. Perry.
Ah, you can't do anything. They'll die from the fright, if nothing else.
Then it'll smell, said Mrs. Perry.
You won't smell anything in here. You're soft-hearted, he went on, looking from one to the other, like all females. Oh, we'll get it if you like.
Why, is one of the windows open?
We can get in through the door.
What door?
Outside here in the yard, the keys hanging up among those.
He went outside and along to the end, opening a small door there. It was a kind of potting shed, really, but a door from it led into the other house, and near the door of the potting shed were six or seven rusty keys hanging on a nail.
This one fits, said Mr. Perry.
He took down the key and put it in the door, and after exerting a good deal of cajolery and force, the key turned rustily in the lock.
I went in once before, he said, when I heard water running. Somebody'd forgotten to turn the water off properly.
He went in, and the two women followed him. The door led into a small room which still contained various flower vases on a shelf and a sink with a tap.
A flower room, I shouldn't wonder, he said, where people used to do the flowers. See? A lot of the vases left here.
There was a door out of the flower room. This was not even locked. He opened it and they went through. It was like, Tuppence thought, going through into another world. The passageway outside was covered with a pile carpet. A little way along there was a door half open, and from there the sounds of a bird in distress were coming. Perry pushed the door open, and his wife and Tuppence went in. The windows were shuttered, but one side of a shutter was hanging loose and light came in. Although it was dim, there was a faded but beautiful carpet on the floor, a deep sage green in colour. There was a bookshelf against the wall, but no chairs or tables. The furniture had been removed, no doubt. The curtains and carpets had been left as fittings to be passed on to the next tenant. Mrs. Perry went towards the fireplace. A bird lay in the grate, scuffling and uttering loud squawking sounds of distress. She stooped, picked it up, and said,
"Open the window if you can, Amos."
Amos went over, pulled the shutter aside, unfastened the other side of it, and then pushed at the latch of the window. He raised the lower sash, which came gratingly. As soon as it was open, Mrs. Perry leaned out and released the jackdaw. It flopped onto the lawn and hopped a few paces.
"Better kill it," said Perry. "It's damaged."
"Oh, leave it a bit," said his wife. "You never know, they recover very quickly, birds. It's fright that makes them so paralyzed looking."
Sure enough, a few moments later, the jackdaw, with a final struggle, a squawk, a flapping of wings, flew off.
"I only hope," said Alice Perry, "that it doesn't come down that chimney again. Contrary things, birds. Don't know what's good for them. Get into a room, they can never get out of it by themselves. Oh," she added, "what a mess."
She, Tuppence, and Mr. Perry all stared at the grate. From the chimney had come down a mass of soot, of odd rubble, and of broken bricks. Evidently, it had been in a bad state of repair for some time.
"Somebody ought to come and live here," said Mrs. Perry, looking round.
"Somebody ought to look after it," Tuppence agreed with her. "Some builder ought to look at it, or do something about it, or the whole house will come down soon."
"Probably water's been coming through the roof, in the top rooms. Yes, look at the ceiling up there. It's come through."
"Oh, what a shame," said Tuppence, "to ruin a beautiful house. It really is a beautiful room, isn't it?" She and Mrs. Perry looked together round it appreciatively. Built in 1790, it had all the graciousness of a house of that period. It had had originally a pattern of willow leaves on the discoloured paper.
"It's a ruin now," said Mr. Perry.
Tuppence poked the debris in the grate.
"One ought to sweep it up," said Mrs. Perry. "Now, what do you want to bother yourself with a house that doesn't belong to you?" said her husband. "Leave it alone, woman. It'll be in just as bad a state tomorrow morning."
Tuppence stirred the bricks aside with a toe. "Oof," she said, with an exclamation of disgust. There were two dead birds lying in the fireplace. By the look of them, they had been dead for some time.
"That's the nest that come down a good few weeks ago. It's a wonder it doesn't smell more than it does," said Perry.
"What's this thing?" said Tuppence. She poked with her toe at something lying half-hidden in the rubble. Then she bent and picked it up.
"Well, don't you touch a dead bird," said Mrs. Perry.
"It's not a bird," said Tuppence.
"Something else must have come down the chimney."
"Well, I never," she added, staring at it.
"It's a doll. It's a child's doll."
They looked down at it. Ragged, torn, its clothes in rags, its head lolling from the shoulders, it had originally been a child's doll. One glass eye dropped out. Tuppence stood holding it.
"I wonder," she said, "I wonder how a child's doll ever got up a chimney. Extraordinary."